Become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2.com. WBAI.org. That's give numeral 2 WBAI.org and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
You can support our station while making a deserving mom smile by ordering a beautiful Mother's Day bouquet. She'll receive a vibrant and textural bouquet from Barbara's Flowers, and a portion of the sales supports WBAI. This beautiful gift is $150 and can be delivered throughout most of New York City. To place your Mother's Day floral deliveries, please call 212-209-2950 or visit WBAI.org. Again, to place your station-supporting floral deliveries, please call 212-209-2950 or visit WBAI.org by May 9th. Thank you.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? hear what's being played on the air? About it, and I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I remember.
Reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
the name of the show. And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. I'm Mike Sargent, and this is Night Shift, and we're going to do something special this evening. We're going to talk about something that is happening all around us. It was on the topic of raciolinguistics. I'm going to say that again. The topic was raciolinguistics, which I am having difficulty saying this time. And we talked about how language shapes our conceptions about race. And we learned that raciolinguistics examines how language is used to construct race and how ideas of race influence language and language use. And now, there's something that we've been hearing about in the news just about every day. We did a show on it a couple of weeks ago, and that is AI. There's a lot of fear about AI. There's a lot of talk about AI. There's a lot of embracement of AI. But here's the thing about AI. You know, AI, and here's what we're going to discuss. Now, for those who... Unless you're living under a rock, you know that AI stands for artificial intelligence. And if you know what artificial intelligence is, well, it's a very sophisticated computer program. It's machine learning, as it were. It's something that can imitate, in many ways, human thought. But I came across some articles because life is like science fiction. And now that AI has entered our lives and science fiction has been warning us about what AI will do, I saw an article that said, AI, why can AI careers start with a degree in linguistics? So that got me thinking. So first, I want to welcome Dr. Kelly Wright. Kelly, how are you?
Good evening. Hi, happy May Day.
Happy
Solidarity
May Day.
With all the striking workers out there across the country.
Yeah, the ones who are lucky enough to still have a job. So, first of all, welcome back to the station and welcome back to the show. And I'm very happy that you're here.
Thank you.
Even though the reason I'm blurry is because, you know, I went to get my computer repaired and they made it worse than it was before. It's been a nightmare. So, you know, first of all, before I sent you this topic about AI and linguistics, you know, what I wanted to do the show about was just how the power of racialized words in politics and advertising and just how we're manipulated. But this is really going to be a deep dive because one thing, you know, artists are afraid of AI for a lot of reasons. Musicians, writers, you know, there are ways in which it can help. Some writers are embracing it, but I don't know how much people have really thought about how AI will be used to influence us. So what's your thoughts just in general about AI before we jump into this? Are you a fan? Do you like it? Do you think it's a good thing?
It's just a huge topic. I think it's here. I think it can be used for good applications, things that are useful, depending on what types of AI we're talking about. Most of us use it every day and we don't notice. So it's already making our lives easier. That said, you know, access brings opportunity.
Okay. All right. Well, we're just getting started here because I have a lot to cover. And like you said, it is a big topic. But to give some context here, you are a linguist, but you're specifically a raciolinguist. So for those who have not heard you before, how would you describe what you do?
I am specifically an experimental sociolinguist and lexicographer. The type of linguistics I do is because what I'm interested in generally is how the social history of the world selects for us a pool of language to interact with. And that selection is inevitably conditioned by our bodies, you know, that we exist as animate material, right? So that affects how we move through the world. In terms of race and racialization, my work in machine learning has looked at how a word or other linguistic behaviors with no pre-existing racial connotation over time come to pick up or characterize people of color asymmetrically. So there, yeah.
Okay. Would the word woke be one of those words that you would?
Go away.
Okay. All right. So.
No. Okay. Do you want to fight me right now?
No. I'm never going to take up a fight with you. But okay. So I'm going to start this because, you know, you say you've done some studying in machine learning. So how are you surprised at all how quickly we've embraced we as a culture have embraced AI, or is it just something you always thought was going to happen?
Is it quick? Will we say it's quick? Is it quicker than any other technology that we've embraced? I'm not sure. Does it surprise me? I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe the wrong person to ask about that. I am still, you know, trying to suss out how printed text has affected humanity. So.
Right. Well, all right. So here's what I'm gonna set us up here a little bit for in researching this, and like I said, the topics we're going to cover the power and the impact of racialized words in politics and advertising, but more specifically, how AI will be able to use language to manipulate us. Okay, you know, we'll jump after to how an AI career can start with a degree in linguistics. Was that a surprising headline to you? Did you know this?
Okay. Not particularly.
Okay.
There are a lot of programmers in my field who get lured into my field.
Okay. Well, it's supposedly it's the other way around. You don't have to be a programmer at all. So here's what they said. Now, I read an article that talked about AI's powers of political persuasion. And this is an article that is from the Stanford University. Okay, and it's their human-centered artificial intelligence, HAI, okay? And this article came out earlier this year. This is from February 27th. It's by Andrew Myers. And in the article, they talk about how researchers at Stanford University wanted to see if AI generated arguments that could change minds on controversial issues, okay? Now, I'm not going to read the whole article, but there are a few things that stood out to me. So they did this experiment. They had these things written. They had people read it. You know how data is collected. And at the end, they said here that the AI fared quite well indeed. AI-generated persuasive appeals were as effective as ones written by humans in persuading human audiences on several political issues. It says, for instance, the authors report that AI-generated messages were at least as persuasive as human-generated messages across all topics. And they talk about the topics were smoking bans, gun control, blah, blah, blah. And he said an additional metric, the team asked participants to describe the qualities of the text they had read. And AI ranked consistently as more focused, it was more factual and logical, less angry, and less reliant upon storytelling as a persuasive technique. Now, the last part here is really, for me, where it starts to go into the science fiction part for me. Hmm. It says, the researchers undertook the study of political persuasiveness not as a stepping stone to a new era of AI-infused political discourse, but as a cautionary tale about the potential for things to go afoul. Chatbots, they say, have serious implications for democracy and for national security. The authors worry about the potential for harm if used in a political context. Large language models, like GPT-3, might be applied to ill-intentioned domestic and foreign actors through mis- or disinformation campaigns, or to craft problematic content based on inaccurate or misleading information for as yet unforeseen political purposes. Now, that is sort of an ominous and jam-packed sentence there. So let me just ask you, hearing something like that, now, what comes to mind for you in just in terms of the use of language? And I guess specifically what I believe is, you know, I had an argument on, I shouldn't say an argument, I had a conversation on another show I do about, you know, whether or not writers could be replaced by AI. And my thought is that if we get used to it, if we just get used to reading things or seeing things, just like we got used to superhero movies, you know, it'll just become, it won't seem, you know, robotic. So I want to know your thoughts on that. Do you feel this is the future?
On which point?
Well, all right, let's start. Just on the idea of using AI for political gain, for political messages, for influencing people.
Okay, well, let me start by actually addressing what that study is about.
Sure.
Okay, it's not particularly surprising that the algorithm is as convincing as human writing, because the algorithm is trained on human writing and its task is to mimic human writing. So it wouldn't be very good at what it does. We wouldn't be sitting here talking about it for weeks, months, ad nauseum, if it wasn't good at that one particular task. So we would want it to be as persuasive as a regular person. That's what it was built to do, right? Right? That the, when a handful of individuals are asked what of this was good, we know from studies in all sorts of veins of linguistics that when people are asked to answer questions like that, they give us answers that align with what you might have learned in a grammar class or read in a style guide like Strunk and White. So the idea that they say this language model sounds better because it's got less storytelling in it, it doesn't sound as personal, it's not as emotional, it's not as this, that sounds exactly like what your teacher would tell you. And that's because that's how they programmed it, right? To output language that would satisfy all of these rules that we've all been following for the longest time. So both of those things line up, right? What it was trained to do and how people perceive it, right? Or will tell you what they liked most about it is because they know they're being assessed. Those people have been walked into a university and paid to sit there and answer that question. One of the most fanciest universities on the planet, by the way. Okay. How can large language models be used to manipulate people? The exact same ways that regular human writing is used to manipulate people. That's my short answer. Because they just do it faster and in a bulkier way. Right?
I agree. Now, to me, that opens up a lot of things. So there's another article that I read that I want to And again, this is not just like one side is doing it, because the big picture is that consultants for both parties are, you know, they're taking all this data and they're using it, you know, for fundraising, for persuasions. I mean, I get all kinds of, I'm sure it, once you get on one list, I get all kinds of emails like, this is it. We've got to act now. You know, you get all these messages like, you
alarm,
know, this can't
alarm,
alarm. We've got to stop this, you know. And I get the conservative ones, too. I don't know. I got on that list and they're sure. They're equally, you know, so I really wouldn't want to say I would lean towards one than the other, except in some of the most obvious ways. Now, there's another article. This one is from something called Daily, okay? And it's a JSTOR Daily. And this article is called The Linguistics of Mass Persuasion, How Politicians Make Fetch Happen. Now, if you don't know who Fetch is, then you've never seen Mean Girls, and so it doesn't really matter. I feel like you've seen
it. Sorry for you. Like, go watch it.
Go. If you've never seen Mean Girls, then, you know, you don't know. Okay.
Technically, it's a Christmas movie. Save it.
But there's something from this. I mean, the article, the title of the article tells you a lot about, obviously, what it's about. You know, the linguistics of mass persuasion. Okay. Now, but this is the part that stood out to me. And then I want you to help walk me through some of this, because it uses words that I'm not familiar with, and I'd rather ask you what these words mean. Okay, it says language is an important force in shaping the political. This is according to Daniel T. Rogers, who views American political language throughout the history as a field of combat. Words are weapons to be used, battlegrounds to be conquered or defended. In the matter of swaying public opinion, political rhetoric can get pretty vicious. It's easy enough to trade well-worn slurs and suffer the social consequences, but what we're beginning to see is the more subtle the manipulation of language and the more unobtrusive the word as weapon becomes, the more insidious its effect is on an unsuspecting public. Now, let me stop there for a second. What are your thoughts on the whole idea of political language, a field of combat where words are weapons? Do you agree with that?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm sure you've seen Arrival, right? Like that quote,
yes,
like,
I love it.
Oh, words are the first weapons drawn in a conflict. Like, that is so. Certainly before we find ourselves on the battlefield, when armies have been amassed, we've been speaking, you know, abrasively to each other for an extended period of time. And as we watch language change, as we watch, populations become marked by conflict, right? Migration and emigration, separation, lots of shuns happen during war, right? And because of that, you know, we watch language changes as those things that people are referring to do. When we think about how it gets used in politics, it's, you know, a campaign, right, is certainly based around a slogan or certain points of propaganda. But we also hear in different directions politicians being like celebrated and or pilloried for their use of language, like on the campaign trail. So, you know, we can think about like Lee Atwater in 1981, saying like in 1954, you could say N-word, but now we talk about forced busing instead. Because when we want to address like the black populations, we're trying, and he's saying this in like a political stump speech, right? Like this is part of what he's shopping around. We almost can't imagine that being part of political discourse today, but we see a lot of things in political discourse we didn't used to imagine were possible that absolutely ignite people. So I think the only way to amass a popular campaign is through the appropriate application of language in a time or place.
Well, you know, what that brings to mind now, just if I'm embracing that, the whole idea of a field of combat is you have to kind of create a conflict. So you create an issue, create something that's, you know, I don't even have to say the biggest non-issue that has become an issue. in the political debate now that has been completely weaponized. And even the words themselves, I saw something on social media that showed the movie To Wong Fu. Now, I don't even know if that movie could come out now. I mean, there'd be protests for it. And it was a number one at the box office. So are we...
Skip Mean Girls, watch that. then Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, back.
Right, exactly. Queen of the Desert, movies like that, if they were to come out now, the company that's distributing it, there'd be people, protesting it.
Literally, Disney's in court.
Sure. Exactly.
The happiest place on earth.
Exactly. The happy and gay. So here's my question. Well, let me finish this. Okay. Because here's the question. How to make neologisms happen. Talk to us, explain the concept of a neologism before I even talk about how we can make them happen.
Happy to do so. Okay, neologisms are new words. What a fun word for new words.
Neologisms,
How does a new word happen? Well, in the idea of fetch, right, it's actually a great example. So for, the people who haven't seen Mean Girls, just, strap in for a 15-year-old spoiler or something. The girl who's trying to make fetch happen is trying to make that new slang, right? And try to get people to say it. That's so fetch, right? Okay. So she's stop trying to make fetch happen. Stop trying to make it happen because it doesn't usually work that way. By the way,
That was a pretty good impression there.
Thank you. it doesn't usually work that way. Every single person on the planet is using language, even if they can't speak, right? If they are signing, right? Or whatever, any ways they communicate, they're using language in a unique way, in a way that's it. Language is always being generated and new, the sentences are new. They're not predictable. And the same way with words. And when we pronounce something weird and we're that was fun. And then it catches on and it becomes the way an entire region says something. There's lots of different ways that happens, but one way that it is very difficult to make it happen is deliberately. Right. So deliberate language change absolutely exists. You can coin a new phrase or a new term. Something like Comirnaty, right? Which was the brand name of the COVID vaccine. So before it was Johnson & Johnson or whatever, this and that. And so the Pfizer vaccine became brand name Comirnaty, right? Which many people are not using, but it's still a new word, right? That was absolutely coined, that was said please take this out into the world. So we can think of any type of branding as the creation of a neologism, unless it isn't, unless your brand is something a regular word, sandwich. this is my brand sandwich or whatever,
Well, what's funny is I love the accent and the imitation, because right now there is someone who's trying to create a new word. And you know who that is, I'm sure. Hopefully you don't. If you don't know, then I think it's good, because it's not working. But Paris Hilton has a word that she's trying to create. It's called sliving. Do you know about this? Yes, it's slaying and killing while living your best life. That's her new phrase, sliving. Just so you know, just helping you out there with some neologisms. Forced.
Yeah, I don't
forced.
Need that linguistically.
You don't
it's
need that word.
It's not as bad as 2G.
No. All right. So then here's the thing. Now, in the context of the political discourse, he says here. So how does this all work? How do we make neologisms happen? He says the answer is naturally more complex. Now, this is coming to some of what you said here. Then we can cover. He said, let's first look at how neologism might catch on in language. Unfortunately, we don't exactly have a secret formula to how to make fetch happen. However, if certain conditions are met, a new term or word sense can have a pretty decent chance of loitering with intent in a language.
And felicity conditions.
Yes. Is that what say that again?
Felicity conditions.
Okay, yeah. I like that. What does that mean exactly?
Like, you need like a je ne sais quoi. You need a little something extra to make it go. And that's the thing is, like, we, you know, who have been theorizing this for the last 50 years have a very small set of things that absolutely need to happen for like meaning to occur, even just like two people to understand something. So this is like, what does it take for something to really become a thing is like, what is more it? Conditions, a huge set of which are undefined.
They are undefined. And so here's the thing now, what would you say, and this is just going slightly off what's written here, but is there an intersection between, let's put it this way. Fetch is something that, like you said, she was trying to create it, and you try and create a catchphrase. I mean, we all know Trump has tried to do that many times where he'll come up with a nickname to insult somebody. I mean, is there an intersection between where something catches on and then, I guess the question is there an intersection between when a new word comes along and then there's maybe even a new meaning, meaning that that word is supposed to mean one thing, but it comes to mean something else, even if we won't use an obvious reference?
Absolutely. So when you look at, Joshua Fishman, 1968. What we're looking at when we're thinking about language change, or what we should be looking at, is who uses what language with whom and when. So in any given scenario where we're thinking about how language is being used, like, all of those factors matter: who, what, where, and when. And so both of these things that you're talking about, where an existing word takes up a new sense, which is exactly what I'm looking at when I'm looking at racialization, right? So in my corpus, I have examples of the word culture, where when it's applied to a white actor, a white athlete, they're talking about how, they're talking about the culture of the sport itself, or, you know, and those types of things, not white culture itself. When we're talking about a racialized actor, they're talking about how that person's presence is influencing the culture of the sport, or how they're bringing their culture into it, how it's like being ethnicized in some way. So those are really different senses of this word. That maybe isn't the best example, because we're thinking about like the popular understanding, and people maybe would read this and think it's the same word being used. They wouldn't necessarily notice that there's a new sense applied, but that's not the same as a brand new word. But the things that make that brand new word have staying power really do depend on that initial point of usage of who was using that language with whom and when, of sort of how it was coined, that give it the ability to change or stay, etc.
Well, all right, now you bring up something interesting here, because as you're talking, the concept of point of usage, culturally and racially, culturally, you know, you can have words that one culture says it uses this word to mean the same thing, but you know, when this culture says that, they mean that. And I saw Roy Wood Jr. recently had and I'm a big fan. He was on the podcast I do once too.
The one where you have famous people. I'm sorry, Roy Wood Jr. Stop.
Anyway, goodbye. Yes, and we had them both on, and so but. He recently, I saw a bit he did, and he talked about forefathers versus ancestors. Black people say ancestors, white folks say forefathers, and you know what they mean and where they're coming from. You never hear a black person say the forefathers unless they're talking about. Now, talk to me about, how does something like that happen? Is that all, like you said, point of, you know, who's saying it, when and why and how?
That's certainly part of it. you know, we can think about how language changes or moves, like differentiates itself, in terms of like age and gender, ability, class, region. Race is certainly part of that. And so, like in the United States, for example, people might say tennis shoes versus sneakers versus trainers versus, right? Or pop and soda and whatever. So the reasons why those types of usages like group out based on region, underlyingly, like linguistically, cognitively, language structurally are like no different. Like that mechanism isn't, different from the one that's pulling forefathers and ancestors apart in like the reference to the same maybe group of like historical figures in someone's like family tree or, you know, cultural conception of like my ancestor, the ancestors. You can maybe think about how Asian Americans or people from Eastern cultures or the way that Eastern cultures are at least represented in American media, you know, that use of ancestors maybe sits in between where those are somehow familial and like state entities in that usage. So I think it's interesting sort of where we can see everybody maybe has a slot for that and how it gets filled differently by others.
Is there a word for that? Like where?
I think that maybe different disciplines would call that something else, or depending on how you're looking at the language. We might call that sociolinguistic variables. So something in the language that varies based on your social position. It doesn't really have anything, that specific type of variation doesn't have anything to do with how long it takes to pronounce the word or what the group of sounds are in it or where it came from in the language or how it's used in a sentence or anything like that. It's really just about like where or whom or when, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, you know, again, there's certain things that you know, words become supercharged. So and as I steer back to politics, you know, there are certain words that I think can become supercharged during the political discourse. You know, a word like diversity, you know, there's a long period where that's a good thing. And then there's the period where that's something to, you know, like nobody says America's the melting pot anymore. What happened to the melting pot? You know, what happened to the melting pot? So, now,
like, don't get me started on the melting pot.
Don't get you started on the melting pot. What are we going to say? You got some melting pot. Well, okay. Now you are, and before I read a piece of this next article, you are a raciolinguist, and as you said, you study. It's a sociolinguistic discipline. Is that? Am I getting that right? Is it part? How am I?
What study? Which part?
How is that categorized within linguistics? Is it
raciolinguistics? It's a burgeoning field. Okay. So it's I don't think there's anywhere on the planet you can go get a degree in it specifically
until you have your course. All right. Well, then let me ask you this. You know, how much does you talk and we have talked about how language, you know, is influenced by race and race influences language, but specifically manipulation and specifically that weaponization, because, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about advertising, but in politics, and as you know, we're seeing here, the whole notion of influencing minds just by words. I mean, it's maybe it sounds obvious, but it's sort of the crux of everything. And if we can just program something, somebody doesn't even have to come up with, somebody doesn't even have to think of it. I'm wondering for you, where do you see raciolinguistics in this configuration of what AI can be used, and how is manipulation factor into what raciolinguistics is?
Sure. Okay. So Thank you. All right. So I, where my work intersects with these conversations is in the space of like automatic speech recognition or other types of, you know, like AI assisted technologies that rely on the ways in which someone sounds. So when you, and how we sound when we're not, when we're thinking about how humans process language and not how machines process language, we're thinking about that. The body of the person producing that sound in front of us or even not in front of us. Well, actually, let's just take in front of us. That really matters. It matters for how we receive language. It matters for how we receive language before we put like any ideologies on top of it, because our body and their body have to transmit sound waves between each other. So it actually really does matter if the person is a lot taller or a lot shorter or a lot bigger or a lot closer or a lot whatever than you, that affects how your ears receive that wave. So how your brain is even capable of producing it. So that just, it just matters. So then you just add on everything we know about other bodies. So all of your ideas about like femininity and masculinity, or, you know, being like elderly or youthful, like to that, like just like those things on just taking those two points. It matters so much, for how we plan our response. So if I'm talking to another like middle-aged woman, then it, that changes how I respond. That changes how I hear what she said and how I plan my next response. Fast forwarding to the ways in which, you know, language can be used to manipulate us. I look at bias and automatic speech recognition and how I categorize that is through imbalance. So those types of algorithms, the same as GPT-3, which is running ChatGPT-3 and Bard and these other things, is that they're really black boxy. In that they're given a set, they're given an input and they produce a certain output with a command, but we don't really know how they do it. And we don't expect them to tell us how. So that input matters. It matters a lot for the output. It's very conditioned. And they certainly do learn, but they learn with that given task in mind that we've asked them, like, you're going to be producing this output. Like, that's how they're trained. So that initial set of data matters very much. So for automatic speech recognition, those initial sets of data just are imbalanced. They contain a lot of data from the 20th and 20, the late 20th and 21st century. So that's like not most of speech or like most of recorded speech or the speech from most places. Like the early versions of these things failed because it was like literally six guys in California. And they were like, oh, it works for us. It works for us. It works for us. It works for our donors. It works for these people. It works for these people. It works for these people. Fails on the Irish and black people and the deaf and like all of this stuff of like our general population needs to use our technology. They built out that balance by stealing phone calls from the imprisoned. But that's a different conversation. Okay. So when I think about how it can be used to manipulate us. Yeah, where were you going to find minoritized populations that you could just pull speech from? Okay, so the things that I think about when I think about how we could be manipulated are things like targeted ads. with our phones here, where many of us have opted into, go ahead and listen to me, like our smart toasters and all these other things that are just pulling our daily life from us. So we don't need to fill out a Pew Research survey anymore. We don't need to fill out these other things that used to get people to specifically ask us, the person who lives at X Lane, how they feel about these candidates. They're just saying, here's how I would like you to feel about my candidate based on your behavior that I have purchased from another company who took it from you for free. That's the sort of thing about how language is being used to manipulate us, is that our own usage out of context, what they assume it means when we go to a certain website, really funnels information towards us. And so people who are, you know, in our very specific gerrymandered district can tell us exactly who to vote for and not give us any other options. It's like when you go to Target and there are five sheets available and you're like, I am 100% a pineapple sheets girl. Thank you. But it's because you weren't a striped sheets girl. You know, it's not really who you are. It's just what was there.
I completely understand. Well, you know, I think that that is true. And that is specifically how we're being manipulated. But I think what AI does, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it just kind of streamlines the process. It's like, now we have all this info. Now we can craft very specific, very quick, very manipulative, very targeted just to you. Because, you know, not only from what I've read, they don't just take the information from your phone. They'll take information from the people you're interacting with, the people in your vicinity, you know, and your mom is looking to buy sheets. So all of a sudden you're going to get ads for sheets. So that kind of thing. So, yeah, so algorithms, and we're all just used to it. But that to me is the scary part, that we normalize it. So this article is from, and one of the things I love, what I do love about the internet is, you know, because I grew up, when I was a kid, there was no internet. So it's sort of like having a library at your fingertips. So I still love that concept, but I love that there's a website for everything. Okay. So, and there's, you know, and you can find it. So this is a website called languagetrainers.com. And this is an article, and I think the title of the article speaks for itself. And this is from 2016, okay? So this is more about the theory. This is not specifically what's happening right now. But there's an article posted by an author here. Her name is Katie. There's a bio on her. But the title of the article is Orwell Got It Right, : Language Manipulation. And then she has real-life examples. And she breaks down her article into a couple of sections, and I'll just read the titles of the sections, which I think should tell you a lot here. So, the potential consequences of language manipulation, real life language manipulation, the case of U.S. media, language manipulation in Australia, refugees or illegals, and finally, language control after 9/11. And she cites how American politicians liked to use the word, and this word that we got used to, but the word homeland. And I think that that's a very good example of that. That is a word that existed before, but never in this context. And it became very politicized, very weaponized. There's a homeland security now. So, and this is just something that came out of something that happened to the culture. So I'm what she says here, and I'll just read this part and then I want to jump back to you. She says here, she says, while it was rarely heard prior to 9/11, it grew in acceptance following the attacks and is still used tirelessly today. And this was 2016 she was talking about, and it's still happening. Politicians utilize language manipulation to plant in our brains some misguided idea of patriotism. Now that is pretty much everything we're living now. It says, through their language, they're influencing us into believing that the U.S. must be protected because it is our homeland. At the end of the day, this sort of manipulation by the media and the people of power really only leaves us more vulnerable. The language, the fear-mongering, and the mental manipulation destined to make us feel afraid of the unknown, to fear the rest of the world, has some very unfortunate results. Now, I am just interested to you, do you see a correlation between how language is used, and is it okay to say language is used against people of color? Is it okay to use it that way?
I'd have to think about the context.
Okay, think about the context. Okay, but do you see a correlation between how, let's just say, people of color, women, LGBT, you know, that community, all that language is used and weaponized to otherize the communities, and again, how that plays into politics. Do you feel just the other is a big part of it, and how how does raciolinguistics factor into that? And is there a sexual component or a binary component to raciolinguistics?
Question went in a different direction than I thought it was. The that's being right about like put language was used at these times. That is again something that is certainly not particularly interesting, because we can think on now, think about how any nation processes of independence throughout the single one of those countries as they freed them. Look at the ways in which they established creed and, right? Like the name of these things, like what is our pledge and what linguistic endeavors that have to do capture the hearts and minds of a people. Same processes have been in the world. So this information about the process and people get taken into Egypt, bringing actually from all across the world and citizens. I'm saying you are, these are your gods. These are, they were not necessarily, but literally a lower class of people are from anywhere else. These are our people. Those linguistic processes, like you tell people, not British, you get, these are your words. These are your songs. Then after 9/11 and say, this is how we shore up our, something that makes you like the same process telling us how to label things, point to, right? Put our faith into, because it's just, it's something that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. Like we can see, it's actually difficult to point in like living memory to things that don't take hold, because they're hard to reach for. I can give you a lot of examples of things that did succeed. We can look at like something like mail carrier or flight attendant, right? Like that was like part of the political correctness movement, which people still talk about political correctness in a negative way, but it's been incredibly successful when we look at, you were asking about like a gendered binary. People wanted to take that out of daily usage. And so we get police officer was a word that did not exist when I was young. And I'm 37. It did not exist when I was young. And when people were first using it, they thought it was going to be silly, that nobody would be able to get those words out in like the time of crisis. Right. But everyone uses that word without thinking about it these days. That term. And it was introduced because policeman was gendered, right? And that was part of the political correctness movement, which everyone makes, a lot of folks point towards a different type of thing, like identity politics or something. But it was really just those sorts of defaults, like mail carrier instead of mailman, right?
You think they'll ever ungender God, like, and stop calling it him?
I don't know. It depends. To whom are you asking? You know, there are certain.
I'm saying the general culture. I mean, I know there are people
like Western culture. Yes. I feel like, you know, I think it depends on. Yeah, will Christians stop doing that? Will, like, organized Christianity, religions that circle around this text that's very specifically defined. I think that those people will continue to follow that definition as long as it's there and supported, right?
No, I do agree. Well, I have to say there are a number of words and things that come to mind. I don't want to go on too much of a tangent of it, but words, they mention here refugee or illegal, an immigrant or a refugee versus an expat. That's just one of those things. There's phrases, there's ways of saying things that just land differently and you take in differently and they soften it. I mean, you identified sure. a but for those who don't know, can I give out your Instagram? Because you have a lot of great.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right, you give it out.
Or my Twitter. Yeah, I'm at Raciolinguistic. LINGUISTIC on Twitter, and it's Betty Machete, ETTE on Instagram.
Betty Machete. You know, what's funny is Sean, who was on with you for a while, she was calling you Betty. And I thought that was just great that she just kept calling you Betty. Because, you know, for a while, you know, you could be Betty. Where did that come from? Did you just make that up?
It was an old gamer tag.
Ah, okay. Well, you had a great article on social media that you pointed out, or it was breaking down how something was covered. You know, this transgendered woman who was in a race with 14,000 other runners, and how they made it seem, just from the language, as if this person had run the race and got a medal and was giving it back, when in reality they came in like
7,000 or something like that.
Right? Yeah. And it was just a participation medal. But just leaving out certain things, leaving out certain details, really is another way. The lack of words can be just as powerful as the use of words. Just leaving out, just the rearrangement of words can really completely change how something.
Yeah, there's this excellent page on Twitter. It's Change in Abstract, and all that they do is like edit headlines. So there's just the actual headline, and then they like cross it out and make it like more like less obscure, or like, you know, more inclusive or more accurate or less passive, these sorts of things. Because yeah, we take a lot of things at face value. And that's not to say that we're lazy or that, you know, we're not engaged. It's really how our cognition works. So we're sort of fighting that. In that we're pattern recognizers. We come to anticipate things in our environment. What alarms us or makes us even take notice or interest is something that is maybe different, that stands out, that, or is like a new iteration of something that's regular that we're interested in. And so seeing these types of language that are used in like these really set frames that, don't give us anything that's maybe unexpected. So the groups of people who are being told like this trans athlete, like, you know, 14,000 people, the way that that's framed, we know that there's an audience that's going to assume that they came in first. It's part of how it's crafted. That same story reported in a different place tells us what place they came in, right?
100%. Well, there's another article that I want to quote here, and this is from American Scientist. And this is an article called The Art and Science of Manipulative Language. And the subheading is, how does the brain handle speech that is intended to mislead in advertising or political rhetoric, and even in ordinary conversation? Now, this is another word that you probably know better than me. We as human beings, as homines loquentes, are you familiar with that phrase?
I know what those words mean, but I don't know what it's referring to specifically in this usage now.
All right. It says here, we rely on verbal language to carry out many functions, to make ourselves understood, to learn about facts or ideas, to spread cultural values, and to introduce people to what we want them to. That is, to manipulate other people. Human communication takes place on several levels at once. Not just speech, gestures, body language, also messages that are implied but not explicitly uttered in words. Now, you said something earlier that, before I finish this, that struck me, you know, just how, who says it and what their body even looks like, how likable they are, the tone, you know, what came to mind as you were talking. You know, you see castings for voiceover, you know, and we're on radio. And in the castings, they may ask for an authoritative voice. How did that voice become what we recognize as authority? So are there certain, to your knowledge, are there certain ways in which we are either programmed, or is it just our nature to respond to certain words in certain ways? Is it nature or nurture?
Well, it's a bit of both, okay. Which is not a satisfying answer.
No, that makes sense.
The nature, so language responds to the social history of the world. All species respond to the social history of the world. Where language evolves, its language changes continuous and ongoing, just like the human species is evolving, our genome is evolving. Language, which to me, like what you read from that article, the thing that upsets me the most about it is that they say language isn't just speech. That the primacy of speech over the other forms, the way that they're saying, oh, you use your body, oh, you do this, that it's all language. Like, there's nothing different between speech, writing, and sign. We're using that. We use symbols. We use our bodies. We use the sounds we can make with our faces, and our faces themselves to communicate. Any and all of those channels can be used simultaneously or separately and still externalize thought, right? So, and as a species, we use that mechanism, that externalization of thought, as part of how we evolve over time. So, you know, like bats and dolphins and chinchillas and all of these other creatures that listen very well also use the ways in which they interact with the world. All of those creatures have learned how to live in our built environment, right? Know how to interact with streets and lights and people and things that change over time. Okay. So what was your final question?
Well, actually you brought up more questions. So I guess my final question is, well, all right, that question actually seems irrelevant now, because you made me think about just how much language is not just talking. There is a whole lot. Like my cat, you know, I had a cat. I totally understood what the cat was saying. I knew different meows. So the question was whether it's nature or nurture.
Okay. So nature or nurture, it's certainly nature, right? Because part of what we're doing, we come into the world. There's good studies about this. They're all from the 70s. We come into the world anticipating what's going to be in our environment. So like birds, for example, like they have like, there's like a warning call, you know, like they know there's going to be predators in the environment. It's anticipating that, like a predator, of being out there. We anticipate a lot of things existing in our environment. And before we actually start using language in any intelligible way, we're already, orienting towards the place that our like body and social station and region and all of these other things like place us in this like pool of language that we can interact with. So when you're asking about, these things about nature versus nurture, nurture does play a role. It certainly does, because it has to do with the kinds of things we're exposed to. You know, I didn't grow up in Finland, right? So I don't know Finnish, and those sounds might sound very different or confusing to me. But somebody who grew up there, that's not going to be different or confusing. My Southern accent might be different and confusing to them. And so that has to do with nurture, you know, that in taking a broader example, if I'm hearing an accent which I identify as foreign, that foreignness may be coded as bad or good depending on where I am placing that voice. So, you know, this person might sound British, and it's like, you know, big, but are they British? Like, is it a British accent from somebody who might be from like Pakistan? or, you know, am I hearing somebody from like Leeds, you know, or Jamaica or whatever, right? Like, is it the colonized world or is it the center? Am I hearing somebody who sounds like they're from Eastern Europe and I'm giving them grace for being a language learner? Or am I hearing somebody who sounds like they're from El Salvador and I'm not giving them any grace for being a language learner? When both of these people are probably equally multilingual, right? They all speak at least like 5 languages and have worked really hard to get in this country. Right. Okay. So it's just a thing about like nurture does matter. It doesn't necessarily say like, both of these things are really difficult to combat when we think about what linguistic justice looks like in the moment or whatever, but what you're pointing to, these points of usage and change in language really do have to do with both. It has to do with our cognition and the way we apply it.
All right. Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and we are talking with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is a raciolinguist, and okay, for some reason I'm not seeing you. Who is a raciolinguist, and you want to give out your info? We gave it out a minute ago. You have some social media people could follow you, and you know, you've had some. Do you have a YouTube channel or page?
I do. Yeah,
where can people hear you?
All of this is all cross-linked, but yeah, it's just Kelly Wright on YouTube, which is, you know, it's a very generic name. But.
Yeah, well, you got to spell right. W-R-I-G-H-T. So, and you are still tuned, and we're going to talk in a few minutes about, now that we've been talking with this raciolinguist and we've been talking about AI, we're going to talk about why an AI career can start with a degree in linguistics. You are still tuned a listener-sponsored radio at WBAI, and we're still here with Dr. Kelly Wright. Kelly, some people have been calling, even though I haven't given out the phone number. So I will give out the phone number. We can take some calls and talk a little bit about this topic. But so here's what you said. It didn't necessarily surprise you, but now this article is, keep in mind, from 2017. Now, and there are more articles, but what I've started to think here from what you're telling me, considering how much, of course these AIs wrote articles or wrote things that sounded a certain way because that's what they were told to do. This is what they were taught to do. This is what they were fed to do. This is what they are meant to do. So the better information you give them, the better information they can regurgitate or imitate, correct? So the more you know about language, the better you can train an AI, I would think. No. Well, here's what it says. It says here, why AI careers can start with a degree in linguistics. It said if you're looking to start or land a career in the artificial intelligence field, studying linguistics is a great place to start. It says a linguistics degree traditionally prepares students for careers in academia, professional writing, or translation. But as technology continues to advance, these graduates are finding their skills in high demand from an unlikely positions in artificial intelligence. Companies in the AI market are turning to those with linguistic backgrounds to help aid in things like product development and customer service. And they have a woman here. Her name is Katerina Balcells. She's the chief linguistic officer at a conversational search technology company. Now, it says here, linguistics is important to better understand users and how they're communicating with the company. So what are your thoughts on folks in your field going into this field? Do you think it's a good thing? It'll just make AI better? Do you have any thoughts? Or is it just, it just makes perfect sense to you?
No, I mean, it does make sense. I think for one thing, it's a good thing because we certainly do need careers outside of the professoriate for our graduates in the discipline. But there have always been linguists involved in the creation of more advanced machines because programming is a linguistic endeavor. So any line of code that is written is essentially creating a very specific language for that machine to follow or know or to understand its commands. So computing itself, when we move out of, or even initially when we're thinking about binary, I mean, that is a language. And so you really can't build these types of machines without using linguistic data or understanding linguistic structure. So for folks who end up in those disciplines without degrees in linguistics end up getting training in the same types of theory that we do because it's essential for building more functional programs. I would love to see more linguists or more linguistic training or theories applied to the ways in which these machines are built because of those points of bias or imbalance that I talked about. When a lot of people hear the word bias, they think about the big isms, you know, like ableism or ageism or sexism. And when I think about it, I really do think about it in terms of the types of language that's not represented. So in most of these corpora or bodies of language data that are fed into these machines, we don't have anything that's produced by children. Anyone who's under the age of 18 or 16, then many of those people interface with these technologies. So we can just think about that as a bias towards youth. Right? That like younger people aren't involved in the creation of these machines. And yet there are these like large groups of people who interface with them and are targeted as consumers. But their language isn't considered real because they're not voters. And so that's a major issue, when we think about bias and imbalance, the way that these products are produced and implemented, there's an imbalance there. It's biased towards older people.
That's just
one example, right?
No, but that's a very interesting point. I really hadn't thought about it that way. But yes, you're right. I mean, it also kind of goes into, I guess, anything that's programmed. You have to think about the bias of the programmer, you know, whether it's artificial, you know, face recognition or anything.
Well, and face recognition, so this, you know, coming under fire again and will be forever because of these same reasons, because of its use at the border. So Biden, the Biden administration's solution to the border crisis, is to give people an app with which they can schedule an appointment for asylum. But of course, most of the people who are seeking asylum don't have phones or power. But aside from that, if they actually can get an appointment, the only way to schedule one is with face recognition. You have to upload a selfie. Live with the face recognition software, and it doesn't work on dark skin, which is an issue that we've known about since the implementation of sensor technology. So as soon as we started having doors that would open for you if you walk through them, or faucets that would turn on if you stick your hands underneath them, those things didn't respond to dark skin. We've known about it for over 3 decades. But this app that's supposed to allow people to get asylum just like literally can't see your face if it's too brown. Like, what does that mean for the kinds of people we're letting into the country if the machine that's supposed to give you an appointment can't see your face? Like, or only sees white faces. Okay. Like, this is all the same. That sort of bias is like baked into that type of technology. It's not like the Biden administration was sitting there rubbing their hands together being like, how can we keep brown people out? You know, but it's like these things are known. They're known. And those technologies just continue to get applied over and over again without fixing the problem. Okay. I'm going to take a breath.
Well, you're absolutely correct. Well, you are tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, and somebody's been calling for a while. I'm going to see if I can take that call. I answer the call. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
I wonder.
Hello?
Is it I?
Yes.
Hello, are you talking to me?
Yes. Who is this?
Oh, this is Connie.
Hi, Connie.
Hi, good. I really love all the questions you're posing, and for some reason, I kind of tune off whenever she talks. It's terrible to start to talk, and then I'll just feel, because I think it's because I'm so interested in the questions that you're putting out. You know, I just sort of go into a dream of what that would be. For one thing, I don't understand this last thing about 3 decades where they can't get a black person. I mean, please, can't they put a bright light? Can't you say, you know, you have to have this certain bright light? But, I mean, people can get pictures taken no matter what they look like. Come on.
Well, let's just say makeup, lighting, hair, all of that was not designed for people of color for quite some time.
But this is important. This is important. That's the style.
Oh, saying
this is getting into the country. Yeah. You know, I mean, I would think that there'd be a little more push on it, but that's one thing. And another thing is, I had to study French in school, and it was always like, it sounded like that. And then the first time I heard stuff from Africa, and it would be like, it would sound like a tuned drum. It was a beautiful sound to hear French. I mean, it was, at first I was laughing. I thought people were kidding around. But it's just the way that people talk in Africa or even Haiti, you know, colonial black thing of how they speak this gutless, as far as I was concerned, language of French, where it was always like all on one little ripple. And also, like, I'm a singer and a proofreader, so I'm very interested in this conversation. But when I when I'm walking along the street and I hear like an argument between two people, you know, or sometimes even a mother and kid, I will feel as if there is, that one of the people is right, no matter what. Because I'm, you know, obviously I don't know anything about the, what's going on, the context, but it will be by the tone of voice. There is a kind of tone of voice of a person who's actually telling the truth, or at least the truth as they know it. And I don't know what it is exactly, but I certainly know it when I hear it.
Well, that's an interesting statement. And I'm assuming you didn't have a question, though, for Kelly.
No. Okay. Really, no question. So
no,
I can,
no, it's
I can
okay.
jump off if you like.
No, but I appreciate what you're saying, and I want to throw that to Kelly. But thank you for calling, Connie. Kelly, you know, the whole idea of knowing the truth when you hear it. Now, if there is such a thing, okay, and everybody's perception is everybody's perception, but if there is such a thing, couldn't that be imitated too?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, isn't
this
that the essence
question.
Of so, isn't that the essence of poker?
Like, go ahead. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was saying, isn't that the essence of poker?
I mean, the thing is, like, yeah, our caller brought up some really interesting points. I think one, you know, of that we can come back to the Francophone world. I could talk about that for 100 years. But the this idea that. You know, of authenticity or provenance or, you know, ownership or truth in language use. That kind of stuff has always been a little squishy, or difficult to define for the same reasons that we were talking about earlier with like making fetch happen or how something catches on is like, it starts in like a group or a place or like, it's, you know, indicative of a time or tied to a certain user. Like those kinds of things are really difficult to like nail down. And so when we think about knowing if something's real, it's really relevant for the conversation that we're having of like, if we're looking at art that is made by, you know, an AI, how do we know that's not made by a person, or how do we know that it's not stolen,
or a photo? How do we know
or
it's
a photo?
Real?
And this is the thing, is like, look at other leaps in technology, you know? So when we first started printing things, and saying they were written by certain people that they were not written by, you know, we started saying, hey, this comes from this group or this church or this author, and that was not real. You know, we started printing things that weren't fact, and then we get like libel laws and all kinds of other things. When we start looking at CGI, like really coming in, I mean, even before that, think about photos, like daguerreotypes were edited. Right, like when we think about historical photos, when people think about what
the invention of Photoshop, the invention
like.
Of
yes.
Photoshop.
Photoshop is as old as the camera, and so we have conceptions of what edited images look like throughout history, and that is something that has been evolving as our ability to create image has evolved. And so right now we're at a place where we're at like this cutting edge where things are fooling us, or people are being fooled by these kinds of outputs. But our linguistic evolution will always outpace the tools we build. It just will.
I tend to agree. Well, it's interesting what you said now. I mean, in terms of AI, because, you know, we're talking about language because I have you on here, but we touch upon imagery because, you know, we're in an age where people, politicians, people in power are lying more than ever. We're in an age where, you know, opinion, everybody gets their opinion from everybody gets their point of view from somebody else. Everybody gets their opinion from somebody else's opinion. And now we enter the age of AI. So, you know, if we come off the age of what I call the age of lying into the age of complete and utter manipulation. So I don't know if you've even seen, they have political ads. Republicans have political ads that, you know, depict what would happen if we let Biden have another term. Have you seen that AI ad? It's...
No, I haven't seen the whole thing.
You've heard about it. You've seen clips. Yeah. But I mean, this is how, you know, you mentioned earlier how something, I don't remember what it was we were talking about specifically, but something that started out as something good, had good intent, but it can be turned into something, you know, nefarious. So, I guess my question to you now is, you know, knowing that AI can be even smarter, and we have smart people now helping AI, you as a linguist, as a raciolinguist, as someone in this field, as someone who's seeing others in your field go into this field, and, you know, do you have any, what are your biggest concerns for AI? You know, I've talked about what some of mine are. We know what a lot of people are, but, you know, you've talked about the benefits. Do you have any deep concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I would say that, and thank you. So right now, everything we've been talking about falls into the category of narrow AI, right? It's something that has a very defined task, you know, that's being told and will learn, but it learns within this, you know, defined set of its like inputs and parameters, like what it's being fed and what it's being told to do. What we don't have yet is like general AI, something that would approach what every movie or show you've ever seen has defined as like an intelligence, like itself, like something that could make its own choices, would have will, if not free will,
sentience. You know,
it would have sentience. There's something approaching that. It would be an entity.
V'ger.
Yeah. It would have main character energy. This kind of thing is like, experts right now, depending on who you ask, are saying that we're somewhere between 10 and 30 years away from that happening. I, as a person and researcher, don't expect to see general AI in my lifetime. So like, again, like I'm 37. Like, so I would like to live, I expect to live longer than what their high bound. Right. And the reason why I say that I don't expect it is because I would say we're pretty good at predicting how long things will take for us to develop, but we're bad at predicting, like obstacles to that progress. Right. So we can say like, we could put a man on Mars, you know, in X number of years, but anything could happen in those X number of years that will stall that. Right. And so we know in theory how long it would take that, but let's say that we have a general AI in 10 years. In 10 years, on that lower bound, that does worry me. And why it worries me is because of everything we've been talking about, right? To me, now, when I give you my timeline for fixing things, right, of saying, here's how linguists and other researchers can intervene, can build out these data sets so that imbalance isn't there, that we have more data from more places, more whens and more whos and more wheres in this data set. So it just works a little better so that this AI is learning from like a fuller pot of stuff. That to me feels necessary. And if we don't do that necessary work, then we're continuing to, you know, use a flawed mold to cast new parts.
Well, I agree with you, but I'll have to add, I dare say you are possibly more optimistic than me, because I think what influences technology much more than need is, you know, commerce. If there's money to be made, if money can be made, if they're finding that, you know, they're selling more products, developing this technology, they're gaining more, whoever stands to profit for AI to be developed. Elon Musk realizes if he develops AI for all his cars, it'll be one giant AI controlling all his, you know, whatever it is, that will influence it. I can see that happening because somebody will be profiting from that.
And that's to me saying like, maybe we'll get there in 10 versus 30. Someone will push the innovation.
Less than 10.
You know, maybe someone will, to a general AI, I mean, again, like even, I I'm not scared. It's that Elon Musk's like big AI that would run all his cars. Like to me, that might maybe sit somewhere in between. You know?
Okay.
It still has a very defined task.
True. But if it, as you say, as science fiction authors have said, if it grows, what, you know, can, you know, right now there's a phrase, I don't remember the exact phrase, for most people they can't discern between science and magic, you know.
Sure.
How sentience and super intelligence, how could you really, you know, there are people I've met who they say they're human, but I don't know, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So
I just, to me, it just doesn't approach the neuron. It's like what we do, our electrochemical circuitry hasn't been reproduced.
Not yet.
That functionality, and when we come close to that, I will be very afraid.
You already told me the next show. I know what the next show is going to be that I'm bringing you on. I'm going to show you how we're headed We're headed there, okay?
I dream of Janine.
All right, the phones are lighting up. I got to tell you, I haven't even given out the number. So these are people who know the phone number, which is 212-209-2877. This, I think, is a fascinating topic. Let's see who's here. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Okay. Hello, you're on the air. All right. How about this one? Hello, you're on the air.
Mike Sargent.
Yes.
How are you, buddy? I haven't called in a while.
Who's
I haven't
this?
Listened to you in a while. But I've caught a few of your shows, and I've heard Ms. Wright as your guest speak on several occasions about linguistics. I heard your first caller kind of interrupt your show and kind of throw Ms. Wright under the bus about her explanation of...
Well, it didn't have the ring. It didn't have the ring of truth to her. She knows the truth when she hears it, but Kelly didn't have it. Sorry.
Say it again.
No, Kelly didn't have the ring of truth for her. So,
according to her, she fell asleep.
She fell asleep.
Of course, when it comes to languages, it's innate. Well, of course, and imbued with biases. But wondering if your first caller is averse to scholarly discourse. Is that her bias? Do you think? Linguistic.
Maybe scholarly discourse sounds like French to her.
Well, I think it's a part of the cultural agnotology, as they call it. I'll be familiar with that term. Cultural ignorance, or the spiraling down into less and less synapses being fired.
Also known as America. No. But now, and what's your name, sir?
Vernon.
What'd you say?
Gregory.
Vernon?
No, Gregory.
Oh, Gregory. All right, Gregory. Now, did you have a specific comment or question for Kelly?
Well, that was basically my comedic release. Okay, I love your program, my friend, and keep it up.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gregory.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, all right, we're going to take another call. 212-209-29. I'm sorry, 209-2877. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. All right. 212-209-2877. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, who's this?
Hi, this is Joe from Elizabeth. Mike, how are you?
Joe from Elizabeth. Have you been enjoying the show?
So I have a question. When I was a young man, I got an engineering degree because I liked technology. But I made a decision early on that I didn't want to work for corporate. I wanted to do something for the public good. So my question is, what would you tell a young man today or young woman who is interested in AI in terms of how they can use that training and technology for some public good rather than for corporate enrichment?
Thank you so much for this question. Oh my goodness. I will say that exact struggle is one that plagued me as a person and worker, how I use my own expertise. I would say that for a young researcher or an old researcher who's interested in applying their expertise for products to the public good, for people who are not pointing themselves towards academia but want to work on these issues, I think in each of these fields, so when we're looking at natural language processing, like NLP, or in engineering, like the people who are working on these new technologies, either literally, like, you know, the mechanical engineers or people who are building new software, I think there are absolutely groups and places and people and researchers to seek out in those spaces who are really focused on making those technologies equitable. I also know that, like, the National Endowment for the Humanities the, you know, Institutes of Health, like, those groups have initiatives that fund, like, people who are doing work for those exact reasons. There are also a handful of nonprofits out here that are working on accessible technologies. The Southern Poverty Law Center works on making, like, legalese more translatable and more accessible to, like, more groups of people. Just advocating for things, being empowered. You may be an expert in a certain field, but you're also, you know, someone in your community and somebody who can talk about these issues, like, with all of the hats you wear. That was a long list of things. I'll say what I will tell researchers, especially young researchers, is that this is it's a difficult road to walk. It's one that, you know, requires a research team and support outside of what you do, to be able to really combat these institutionalized forces. And that doesn't mean that people are necessarily, like, actively allied against this kind of work. It just means that these things are really big and they're everywhere and they're stuff we don't notice. So when you start to peel apart how they function, it becomes really difficult to then reintegrate what you've discovered into the existing system.
Dr. Kelly Ryan.
Right. I know. Let me put you to sleep with, like,
No. I love it. I love it. Listen, somebody.
I'll try to do it in a fun voice, so maybe you can pay attention next time. Yeah,
exactly. Fetch. All right. So I think that we can take a couple more calls. You know, but you are tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI. We've been speaking with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is a raciolinguist and an amazing guest. Amazing co-host. And you're going to be back here at least once a month, right?
That's right. You can't get rid of me.
I can't get rid of her. She's got the power shirt on. 212-209.
It's Mayday. Power to the people.
Oh, power to the people. Look at that.
That's 212-209-2877.
Let's see who's here. Hello, you're in the air. Hello. Hello, you're in the air. All these phones are lining up here. Let's try this one. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. Who's this?
Hello? Hello?
Yep, hello. Can you hear us?
Oh, I have a comment about something the guest said before about young people having language of their own.
What's your name, sir?
Sir. And there has been slang used by young people and created by young people for many generations now. You can pass that along to her, okay?
Thank you. All right, so he couldn't hear me, and I don't remember you saying that young people don't have a language.
Yeah,
maybe it's a different show. 212-209-2877. And like I said, we're talking with Dr. Wright, and we're talking about how language and AI.
And yeah, let me clarify. What I said was that the language of the youth is not represented well in the data sets that are used to train these types of technologies. So ChatGPT, for example, is actually one that has more younger people's language represented in the data set that it runs on. And that is because a lot of the text that it was trained on was stolen from students. It was taken from students all across the country from the last decade. People who, when they started getting instructional content online, were forced to upload their papers through plagiarism detectors. And those companies that ran those plagiarism detectors sold their writing to organizations that built these kinds of machines. And so when we're talking, when I was talking about Siri and Alexa and these other assistants, those types of assistants do not have, are not trained on speech from children, from the youth. That is absent. Didn't say that young people didn't use language or that it wasn't interesting. I'm saying that their interesting usage is not represented in the body of data that runs those machines. When we look at ChatGPT, it actually does skew younger. There are more younger people's language that's being used in the model that runs that machine, which means that older people are cast out, right? Are not able to interface with that in the same way that they're using language it won't anticipate. Vice versa, right? When younger people try to use Siri, it doesn't hear them as well because their language isn't well represented.
Dr. Kim, that's all I can say is, you know, Dr. Wright. So yes, don't argue with Dr. Wright because she's always right. So, well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. This has been Night Shift. We have a few more minutes left. You know, language can also be fun. It can be manipulative and all those things, but it also can be fun. So I just wanted to end with a little bit of fun, if that's okay with you. Dr. Wright, can we end with a little bit of fun? Okay.
Please, fun.
So I have a couple of things. First of all, I found what was a great article on language-related terms. And let's just see. I want to see how many of them you know. You probably know them all. Allegro speech.
Allegro speech.
Allegro speech. All right, Allegro speech is the deliberate misspelling, respelling, or non-standard alternative spelling of words, like Chick-fil-A.
Okay, or like chicken nuggets.
Yes, like chicken nuggets, exactly. All right, how about this one? Bicapitalization.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Bicapitalization. That's like where you get like a capital letter in the middle of a word, right?
Ah, like iMac. Right, exactly. Or eBay. Yeah. All right. Okay. You know. All right. How about this one? I'm going to have to make sure I pronounce this one correctly. Okay. Clitic.
You're always asking me things that are like the opposite end of the spectrum of linguistics than I do. But clitics are actually really interesting. They're like parts of a word that's unstressed, that like lean. A clitic like leans towards another. So like the in I'm. So like I'm, like the in I'm is a clitic, right? So like and there are things that like lean towards other parts of language. So they kind of don't stand on their own, except for they do because they mean something. Like we know what the in I'm means, but it's not really anything.
Okay. All right. Okay. That, but you say it's the opposite end of the spectrum, but you knew. Okay.
You say
it like everybody knows that. All right. How about this one? Okay, because I never heard of this one. Haplology. I never heard of haplology. See, she smiled. As soon as I said haplology, she totally smiled because she knew exactly what it meant. What does it mean?
So haplology, it's actually something most people are really familiar with. So it's like when you leave a sound or a syllable out of a word. So prolly versus probably. So like, I'm probably going to go da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
Haplology. Is when right. Like you're something, a little something is missing there.
A little something. Okay. All right. This is.
But it's the middle. Okay. It's not the end or the beginning. It's the middle, the haplology.
Okay. There's so many on here. There's 25 here. So I'm just trying to. Okay. How about this one? A rhyming compound. And that's not a place like you go to where they're all, everybody's rhyming. It's not a rhyming compound. So what? Can you explain to
Wouldn't that be so great? I wish
everybody's like, it's like was. Rap okay. University. It's a rhyming compound. A rhyming compound
is like a handy dandy.
Hey, Busta Rhymes is speaking. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh my gosh. A rhyme. Yes. That is Busta Rhymes' personal property. The rhyming compound.
The rhyming compound. That's yep, where,
that's where you go. It's going to get freaky.
There it is.
Yeah. Okay. Handy dandy. Hanky panky.
Yeah.
That's the rhyming. That's your, those fuzzy. Yeah. Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear. Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair. That's, yeah.
Rhyming compound.
Those are your rhyming compounds.
I still like the like a
handy dandy. That's handy like dandy. The yeah.
There it is.
That's too far.
All right, maybe we can take one more call. Somebody's been calling. I mean, I have to say, the phones have been lit up for the last hour. They've been lit up. Let's see if we can get this call. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, let's get to the chat. GPT erotica already. Let's get to the porn robots. Carlos, danger.
Porn robots.
Are we going to get, come on, Mike, let's go there.
No, I think they're going to get? They're going to have like AI generated porn. Like you can put whatever star you want and it'll be in there.
Yeah.
There you go. So.
We should have a show on that.
You know what? I think that you should present that to the program director and see if she says yes.
All right. I'll do it. We'll have Gary Null with us. Hi, everyone.
All right. Thank you.
Today we're going to be talking about, I'm selling Charles Manson spice rack today, ladies and gentlemen. If you pledge right now.
Stop. All right, guys. Don't make fun of poor Gary Null.
Oh, I know.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. So, Kelly, it has been a lot of fun.
Oh, just a pleasure.
And I think should we get in one more last word just before you go?
Okay,
here it is. And now this is spelled, this is a frop, P-H-R-O-P. Do you know what a frop is? See, how come you know? I didn't know like any of these.
It's because of the dictionary. It's because I live inside a dictionary as a dictionary writer.
Like
yeah,
when I open up the dictionary, I go, Kelly.
Yeah. It's weird. It's okay. No one would ever use this. But what it is like a polite statement that you use in like a social context where what you mean is like the opposite. So if someone is saying like,
I don't like to boast, but.
Yeah. Or it could be like a humble brag, or it could be like something like, you know, like, how are you doing? Like, we're groovy. Like, that kind of, like, you're not great. You know, okay. Like, yeah. That sort of thing. And it was, like, it's, like, a 40s-ism, I guess. But I think it's coming back because, you know, people are, I don't know, full of it.
I was just going to say, isn't social media a lot of frop anyway? You know, people pretending things are good when they're not. So, anyway.
Yeah, frop's a fun one. Frop's an old one.
Yes. Well.
It's also a blend. It's like phrase and opposite. So it's like fropposite. It's like you're saying like the opposite of what you meant.
Fropposite. I like that. The fropposite. Well, I want to say, if you've enjoyed the show, please consider making a pledge in the name of Night Shift. You can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Make a $30 pledge. Become a WBAI buddy. Pledge. Commit to once a month for $30 a month. Just if we get 10 of those, if you really enjoyed the show, if you've got a lot of information, if you didn't fall asleep when Kelly was talking, then I think you should make a pledge. 212-209-2950, or you can go online to WBAI.org. And Kelly,
you know, specify which fun accent you'd like to hear me do all
that's right.
show next month.
That's right.
I'll
and,
try that.
And she'll have a new word. She'll create a new whole new word for the show.
Heck yeah.
All right. Soon. Soon come. Until mm-hmm. next time, this has been Night Shift. Thank you.